Listening to KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening, you're listening to Prison Pipeline here on KVOO Community Radio. Today we're talking with Robin Bernstein about the new book, Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. Robin, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much. So Robin, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll start to talk about your book?
Sure. I'm a cultural historian. My areas of specialization are race and racism in the United States from over the past two centuries. So I'm always really interested in the formation of white supremacy. I'm interested in the technologies and the processes by which white supremacy becomes ordinary, the ways that it becomes acceptable, the ways that it seems to make common sense. I'm interested in ideas that don't make sense, but seem to make sense. So ideas like white supremacy and ideas like the idea that a prison should be an economic force. Why should a prison be an economic force? How did that idea come to seem to make sense when in fact it doesn't make sense? These are the kinds of questions that interest me.
And in your book, Freeman's Challenge, you get to the root of that, at least as it's understood here in the United States. Can you tell us about your book, Freeman's Challenge?
Sure, thank you. So Freeman's Challenge is about the origins of prison for profit in the United States. A lot of people think that prison for profit started in the South after the Civil War, and that's just not true. In fact, profit-driven prison began in the North, and it began long before the Civil War. It began in relation to the end of slavery, but it began in relation to the end of Northern slavery, not Southern slavery. The South was actually imitating the North and adapting Northern practices. So my book uncovers the real origins of profit-driven prison in the North. And I tell the story through one person. His name was William Freeman. And he was an Afro-Native young man. First, he was a teenager, and then later he became older, of course. But what happened to William Freeman is that when he was a teenager, when he was 15 years old, he was accused of horse theft. He insisted he was innocent, but it didn't matter. He was incarcerated in the original prison for profit, which is the Auburn State Prison. The Auburn State Prison is in New York State, in the central part of the state, in the Finger Lakes region. So he was sentenced to 5 years hard labor in the Auburn State Prison. He was the son of a man who had become free, a former enslaved person who had become free, and his mother had always been free. He was incensed at being forced to labor for no wages at all. And he was laboring in prison factories, which were run by companies, private companies. He was making things like animal harnesses that were sold to consumers. And he was receiving no money at all for his labor. He was furious and he struck back. And that's what the book is about. It's about his challenge to America's original prison for profit.
When he was imprisoned at that time, how long had private prisons for profit been in operation in the United States?
Well, this is actually a really important distinction. This was not a private prison. Private prisons came about many, many, many years later, many decades later, in the 20th century. So this was a public prison. And this is a really important distinction because we associate profit-driven prisons with private prisons, which are a small minority of the prisons that exist today. And at the time, there were no private prisons. This was that just simply didn't exist. So this was a state prison that was partnering with private companies for the purpose of making money. And what's really important to understand about the Auburn State Prison is that it actually was created for the purpose of making money. It was created for economic reasons. Prior to the Auburn State Prison, prisons had been built for a lot of different reasons. They had been built to punish, for example. They had been built to contain people, who basically to get people off the streets. They had been created to reform people, to convert people to Christianity and convert people to law-abiding lives. But the Auburn State Prison was different. It was created by people who did not have a particular interest in punishing or reforming or even really controlling or containing people who were designated as criminals. Instead, the Auburn State Prison was established by businessmen who were interested in turning what was then a village of Auburn into a city. They were interested in using the prison as an economic tool to change the entire region. And it worked. So it was, and part of the reason this is so important that it wasn't a private institution is that they were partnering with the state to change incarceration, to change what incarceration is or should be, to create this bizarre new idea that prisons should be built to benefit an economy. What a bizarre idea. And the state was a very active partner in that.
I just assume that when you go to prison, one of the things that you might expect if you're an adult in custody is that you basically have to work for almost no wages.
So most people who work in prisons, most incarcerated people who work, are working in for the upkeep of the prison in one way or another. So they're doing things like laundry. They're doing things like scrubbing floors, for example. And that is part of an idea that the prison should not cost the state money, which is, again, a bizarre idea. Why shouldn't a prison cost the state money, or that it should somehow offset the cost, or that it should actually turn a profit? So, and it's true that in Oregon in particular, I'm sure you know this, people who are imprisoned do not earn directly wages. What they earn is they are forced to work. And this has been true since 1994 with ballot measure 17. What ballot measure 17 did in Oregon was require all incarcerated people in prisons to work 40 hours a week. And for that, they receive no wages. What they receive instead is a point system, which then can convert to a monthly quote unquote reward, which is usually $8 to $25 per month. So this is a pretty extreme system where people have no choice but to work, and they're working for no wages directly and a very, very small amount of money. This is exactly what William Freeman was revolting against. And this is exactly the injustice that I tell the story of in Freeman's challenge.
So what happened to William Freeman when he challenged the system? Tell me about his story.
Yeah, well, he challenged the system from the moment he was incarcerated. There were many people in the prison, as there are today, who were challenging the system of forced labor in various ways. So at first, William Freeman, like many people, was doing things like working less, making it appear like he was working more when in fact he was working less. Basically, the state was stealing his labor, and so he was stealing it back. He also resisted by clowning around. He was funny, and he would try to make other people laugh. And I should say that one of the things that was distinctive about the Auburn State Prison, besides the fact that it invented profit-driven incarceration, was that it worked through extreme social isolation. And this was one of the ways in which the prison committed horrible violence. So the prisoners in the Auburn State Prison were put into solitary confinement every single night. Each person, every single one of them, was incarcerated in an individual cell. So solitary confinement all night, every night. And then during the day, they were forced to work in these company-run factories, but they were not allowed to speak to each other. They were not allowed to speak to each other ever at all. They were not allowed to speak to each other in the dining hall. They were not allowed to speak to each other while they were coming to and from the factories. They were also never even allowed to look at each other's faces, ever. So a person could go years in the Auburn State Prison without ever speaking a word and without ever looking at another human being's face. Now, the reason the prison instituted these torturous methods was not for the purpose of punishment. It was for the purpose of controlling the prisoners in order to maximize productivity. Basically, what they were trying to do was cut off the possibility of revolt, of workers working together to resist this horrible system. So William Freeman, like a lot of the people incarcerated in Auburn, found ways around it. I mean, it was a torturous system, and he resisted within it. And one of the things that he would do was make other incarcerated people laugh. He would make silly faces, and they would surreptitiously look at his face, which they were not allowed to do. And they would laugh, and they would have to suppress themselves from laughing because laughter was forbidden. So this was another form of finding a way to have human social interactions within an inhuman system of profit-driven prison. So these are some of the ways that he resisted. And the immediate response was physical violence. He was beaten horribly by guards. He was waterboarded. And I have a lot of information about how the Auburn State Prison actually innovated a new form of waterboarding. So he was tortured, and during one of the beatings was so terrible that it actually caused him to have a brain injury, and it also damaged his hearing. He lost almost all of his hearing while he was in prison. And let's remember that this is a teenager. He went in when he was 15 and he was released when he was 20. So this is a kid who is being beaten in this way. When he got out of prison, he was angry, not only, he was less angry about the beatings, actually. What he was most angry about was the theft of his labor. And his position was that he deserved wages for his work. He was not a slave, and he was a worker, and he deserved to be paid for his work. So even during his discharge, he demanded wages. And he was laughed at and dismissed. After he got out of prison, he went trying to find legal remedies that would enable him to recoup what he saw as stolen wages. So he went to magistrates, multiple magistrates, trying to get back pay. And he was laughed at and dismissed. And then he turned to violence. And that is the central event of the book, how he turned to violence, why he turned to violence. And that people were no longer laughing at him.
Can you tell me about the violence that William Friedman engaged in that got him in trouble again?
Yeah. William Friedman committed a quadruple murder, and he killed four white people who had no relationship to the prison. And no relationship, and who had never, he never claimed that any of those people had ever done him any wrong. So he basically killed four people but he said that the reason he killed them was because he wanted his back pay. So basically what he did was commit an act of terrorism. The fact that they were not directly responsible for his incarceration is exactly what got everybody's attention. Because think about it. If he had killed, let's say, the judge who had condemned him to the Auburn State Prison for horse theft, that would have been a frightening thing to people in the town. It would have been a horrific thing to people in the town, but it would have been very easy to understand. And it would have been very easy to create distance. A person in the town could say, you know, well, there was a murder and that was a terrible thing, but it has nothing to do with me. It was a simple act of revenge. And so in a way, it wouldn't have actually challenged anything. It would have just simply enacted revenge. But instead, what he did when he killed four white people who had not been involved in the prison and had not been responsible for his incarceration, that was a general act against the entire community. That was a terrifying act. And he actually explicitly said that what it was really an attack on was the state. He was attacking the state. He was attacking the entire region that was becoming prosperous because of his labor and the labor of people like him, incarcerated laborers. So it was an act of terrorism. And what we know about terrorism is that it terrifies people. And terrorism will get people's attention and force people to reckon with the statement. So that's what he did. And he did, in fact, terrorize the region. And white people in particular in the region were forced to deal with his claims, were forced to deal with his critique of the Auburn State Prison. But the problem was that nobody wanted to do that. William Friedman challenged the system that was causing the entire region to become prosperous. And he was also challenging the system that brought white Auburnites in particular, but actually all Auburnites, a sense of pride. So the Auburn State Prison and its invention of profit-driven incarceration had made the town, first of all, it had made the village into a town, into a city. It had grown the entire community. It also had made Auburn internationally famous. It made the Auburn system of prison for profit was traveling throughout the entire country and throughout the world. The reason that Oregon has unpaid prison labor is in part because of the Auburn State Prison. It was the idea that originated there and traveled outward. And Auburnites were very proud of this. this was putting Auburn on an international map. So, and Auburn, just the word Auburn, Auburn was the name of the prison. Auburn was the name of the city. And Auburn was the name of the Auburn system of prison for profit, of profit-driven incarceration. So this was a point of pride. So William Freeman challenged not only the system of profit-driven prison, but also the wealth of the region and the pride and the identity of the region. Needless to say, they did not want to hear this challenge. And so what they did not want to hear it. They did not want to deal with it. And that was true of both the people who defended William Freeman and the people who prosecuted him. William Freeman was defended by William Henry Seward, who at the time was famous for having been the most recent, a recent governor of New York State. Later, 20 years later, he became Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State, and he also brokered the purchase of Alaska. So if you've ever heard of Seward's Folly, that's William Henry Seward, and that's the man who defended William Freeman in court. All the people who were dealing with him, those who defended him, those who prosecuted him, none of them actually wanted to honor his challenge. None of them actually wanted to consider whether he had something important to say. So what they did was they all made up their own stories about the quote-unquote real reason William Freeman killed. They made up their own stories that managed to drown out his voice. And those stories in turn became really powerful. And some of the stories that they made up, because they could not hear that maybe there was something wrong with the system at the heart of their city. They could not hear that. They would not hear that. They refused to hear that. So they had to make up their own stories about why William Freeman did what he did. And the story they made up, of course, was that he did it because of race. They did it that he did it because he was Black. And this was one of the origins, one of the really important origins of the myth of Black criminality. Basically, they developed an idea, a theory, a libel of Black criminality in order to not hear William Freeman's challenge to the Auburn State Prison. And that is the story that I tell in Freeman's Challenge.
What would it look like to have a justice system where people are paid the wages that they're due for their labor?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So William Freeman wanted to be paid, and he wanted to be paid a fair wage. He wanted to be paid enough to make a life for himself and after incarceration. So absolutely, people who work anywhere in prison or not should be paid a living wage. And there's a movement toward exactly that happening, particularly in New York State. In New York State, there are two ballot measures that are, excuse me, not ballot measures. There are two legislative measures that are coming up for vote in the New York State legislature this May. So weeks away. One of those measures is called the No Slavery in New York Act, and it is designed to end forced labor of any kind in New York. So in prison or out of prison, the basic idea is nobody should be forced to work. So it's basically trying to eliminate all forms of modern day slavery, including sex trafficking and incarcerated labor. It's not trying to eliminate work, of course. It's not trying to eliminate work in prisons or anywhere else. It's simply trying to eliminate forced work. The second legislative act that is under consideration is directly addressing the issue that you just brought up, which is fair wages. So when people work, they should receive fair wages, and they should have the right to, they should have the rights of other workers. So it's not just about, it's wages are obviously incredibly important, and that was William Freeman's top concern. but should also be things like being eligible for workers' compensation, eligible to contribute to Social Security, for example. When people, when incarcerated people work, their labor does not, their wages do not count towards Social Security. And that can have a devastating effect on their post-prison lives. They should have the right to save money. They should have the right to spend money. They should have all the rights that other people have. So that's what it would look like. Fair wages, protection under the law, the right to contribute to Social Security, the right to workers' compensation, all of these things that non-incarcerated workers should also have.
So what was the outcome of William Freeman's trial? How did his life go after that?
Well, I don't want to give away the end. I wanted the book to be a really powerful read. I wanted people to really feel a connection to William Freeman and very importantly a connection to the cause that he stood for. To feel connected to his claim of rights. So, but I will say that the trial got very big, very fast. It made national headlines, in part because William Henry Seward defended Freeman. He defended Freeman with the claim of not guilty by reason of insanity. It was one of the first uses of that claim, of that plea in the United States. And so that was so, you know, William Freeman has this very high profile lawyer who is working pro bono to defend him with this experimental novel defense. And then the prosecutor was John Van Buren, who was the son of Martin Van Buren, the president, the recent president. So you have these two titans going at each other, and they're both making claims about race. They're both telling these racist stories that are differently racist. And these stories are amplified through the media, through newspapers, and then later through theater and through fiction, fictionalizations of the case. So it gets amplified and amplified. So one of the most important outcomes of the trial is the creation and the development of forms of racism that were at the time novel. These relatively new stories about race and racism and white supremacy were being told in a new way with a new kind of amplitude. And they were spreading through the United States and beyond. So that's one of the really important outcomes. And then there were other outcomes for the Black community of Auburn. One of the amazing things that happened in the wake of the trial is that Auburn actually became a center for abolitionist activism, for the abolition of slavery, not the abolition of prisons. And one of the people who moved to Auburn and settled there for the rest of her life was Harriet Tubman. Tubman became an Auburnite in the 1850s, and she lived in Auburn until she died in 1913. So Auburn was a really complicated place for white people and for Black people. And those complications played out over the half century after William Freeman's trial.
Wow, just so fascinating. So people have to read your book to find out what happened to William Freeman. Robin, tell us again, what is the name of your book and where can people find it?
Oh, thank you so much. The title is Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. And you can find it on Amazon. You can find it in bookstores. And you can also order it through bookstores.
Thanks. And Robin, if people would like to get in touch with you, if they want to find out more about you and your work, how can they reach you?
Sure. Well, you can just Google me, Robin Bernstein. There are quite a few Robin Bernsteins, but in most Google searches, it'll be my website that pops up first. I teach at Harvard University, so if you want to make sure you found the right Robin Bernstein, you can just Google Robin Bernstein, Harvard. I have a website that has a lot of information about me and about William Freeman and about the book Freeman's Challenge.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure having you today on Prison Pipeline on KBOO Community Radio.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KBOO. At KBOO, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KBOO want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KBOO supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to KBOO.